You're listening to a 4x4 Radio Network podcast.
The Center Steer Podcast, a Land Rover podcast by Land Rover owners. Welcome to the Center Steer Podcast, the only Land Rover podcast on the planet. This is show number 44 for November 2016. This is a podcast by, for, and about Land Rover owners. Please visit our website, centersteer.com, to listen to previous shows and for show notes, which have links to the stories discussed on today's show. We are part of the 4x4 Radio Network, and I ask that you check out the other shows that are 4x4 related at 4x4, that's 4x4radionetwork.com. Thanks, everybody, for your comments, your follows, your likes, Twitter, Facebook, emails, and a very special thank you to Gary for his one-time financial contribution. Thank you, Gary. Gary lives in the U.S., from what I can tell. Gary asked us to talk about some crazy mods, so we're going to get some things together for future shows to talk about that. So thanks, Gary, for your contribution to the show. And also, thank you to our Patreon subscribers. Patreon is a simple way for you to support the podcast, and it helps to keep the podcast going and encourages us to do more things, like the special Thanksgiving episode that we had done with the Bells. We have some cool rewards, including a special Center Steer sticker, and also we now have new, very limited supply of Center Steer window clings. So instead of being a sticker that goes on the outside, you have a window sticker that goes on the inside. So I'll send those out to our Patreon subscribers also. And if you want one yourself, go ahead and check out patreon.com/centersteer for all the details and consider making a monthly contribution. So I'm your host, John Kostich, here in lovely Western Pennsylvania, a few days after American Thanksgiving. The sun has finally shone after, I think, 4 days of overcastness. Joining me also from Western Pennsylvania, this time, though, via Skype.
I'm Harold.
And also joining us through the magic and miracle of Skype is from the Green Mountain State.
Hey, I'm Morgan. Unfortunately, we have not gotten any sun up here yet.
But you have snow.
We had snow about a week ago, yeah. Just enough.
And I think some ice.
Yes. Just enough.
I recommend you check out Morgan's Instagram account, and that will explain everything. I think next month, I think, Morgan, we'll have an update on your discovery experience.
Yes, definitely.
But we're going to start with the news. I should also mention our usual contributor, Dave, is not with us today. Dave broke his leg and is now in physical therapy and probably will be for a few weeks. So, Dave, I'm sure you'll be listening. So we want to wish you well and hope you get well soon. Dave, as you may know, is the one always is able to go out and do all the trail rides and bring all that information back for us. This was not trail ride related. It was a kind of just a freak thing that occurred. But Dave broke his leg. What? Right before Thanksgiving, right? Was it like a week before? I think it was like a week ago. But he'll be in physical therapy now, so he's has been repaired, and now he's.
He's now running down all the nurses at his PT home.
He's in a wheelchair.
He is apparently unstoppable now that he's in a wheelchair.
And he's already discussed what mods he's going to make to the wheelchair.
He claims to be faster in the wheelchair than before he broke his leg.
All right, now let's go to the news. First up, JLR sales for October in the U.S. were very, very good. And we'll just do a quick rundown of those. It was the best October. It was the best ever October for JLR. Sales were up 7%. The Jag XE Sport Sedan, the F-Pace SUV were up. Sales were up 226% for the best October they've had since 2004. Land Rover U.S. sales hit their second highest October total. The Range Rover, Sport, Disco Sport, pushed up Land Rover sales by 8% for the year in the U.S. So things are going well, certainly here in the U.S., for sales.
Certainly would be nice to see Land Rover get that 200-something percent increase, but, 8% is good.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I know you hate it, Harold, but I think that shows that there was a demand for the SUV in the Jaguar space.
Well, no accounting for taste, I guess.
On the, I guess, negative side, Tata has sacked their top CEO, Cyrus Mistry, who was the first non-Tata family member to hold the post, was made redundant, in, if I can use the UK phrase. They think, it wasn't confirmed, but they believe it's because they thought he was not running the company as well as they would have liked him to, and he was selling off too much of the company holdings. He's been temporarily replaced by Ratan Tata, if I'm saying his first name correctly, I hope. I did. It was interesting here. I didn't realize this, that Tata owns Tetley Tea and, of course, Tata Steel, but Tetley Tea was the one I didn't know they owned. So there's a the top CEO of Tata is out. Also out are 250 jobs at Sully Hall. They made redundant 250 employees. They believe it was due to the ramp up for Discovery 5 production. And now that phase is complete, they did let those folks go. And part of the article here indicates that this is on the good news side, even though folks losing their jobs is not good. But Land River facility in Sully Hall is running 24 hours a day, three shifts every day for 5 days. In the last 5 years, it has doubled its staffing while tripling its output. While they did lay off some folks, 250 of them, it doesn't seem like there's any real problems, at least in the foreseeable future for JLR when it comes to production.
They're just getting the job done with fewer people now.
Yeah, and they probably needed some more people to, you know, switch over to the new production line. Because didn't they not completely change how they built the Discovery 5? I think there was more of a major change than they hadn't done in the past.
I think so. And, you know, from the marketing side, churning out all those custom camouflages, that could have used quite a few people.
Harold will do that for free for them. What are you talking about?
Well, the D5 is unibody, is it not?
I believe so, yes.
So that's a very different construction method than body on frame, so I could see a lot of changes in the plant having to happen.
Moving on to future news, JLR says that half of its new cars will have electric option by 2020. This was announced at the Los Angeles Auto Show. So they're looking at, again, having half of the fleet have an electric option, but they're still going to, you know, continue to have diesel and petrol engines, and plug-in hybrid vehicles will all be part of its plans.
And I would certainly like to see the plug-in hybrid options come to the Land Rover side.
Absolutely. Indeed. I mean, I know we like our petrol engines, but having better fuel mileage would certainly be very helpful.
And the plug-ins, it's a good in-between from just standard hybrids and fully electric. Because when you're driving your, you know, electric Land Rover just around town during the week, you can basically be running fully electric and then just switch over to hybrid when you're doing long trips, which is very convenient.
Right, gives you the range extension that is usually the concern. Although there are more and more electric refueling stations, is that what they're called? Charging stations available throughout the U.S. And I think in Norway too, if I remember correctly, or is that Sweden? It still takes more time to recharge an electric vehicle than it does to, you know, fill it up with 30 gallons of gas.
It's true, but I think a lot of cities and businesses are doing the right thing and placing the electric charging stations in areas where you generally would be spending a fair amount of time, like up here in Burlington, which is sort of, well, it is the biggest city in Vermont. Most of the large grocery chains have electric charging areas, as well as the sort of downtown shopping area. So when you're just out shopping or going out to dinner, you can plug in and charge during that time, and you're not spending extra time going and waiting for it to charge.
Well, Vermont is more progressive than Pennsylvania when it comes to that. That's not the case here.
Probably a few other things.
Along the lines of the electric, the 2017 Range Rover Sport Coupe is supposed to go, could go all electric, which we just mentioned that kind of fits in with the previous story. But the interesting thing about this story, which was from Autocar, is they had pictures of the new Range Rover next to a Toyota Tacoma and looks like a Chevy Silverado. And so you can get a sense of the sizing, which is definitely smaller. And then they have a picture of the boot open, the trunk open, and it looks up to me about the size of my Jetta sport wagon. Sport coupe is coming. Could be, there's some more pictures if you want to see those. Take a look at the story. I believe it's due out in 18. So that would be another year and a half to go. It might be out in a year for the 2018 models. Model year. And there was something else about this I wanted to mention, and I can't think of what it was.
The I-Pace, maybe?
Well, this is part of the family option, that the families that they have, and this is going to be in the Range Rover family, and it's going to be slotted between the Evoque and the Range Rover Sport. Although they did confirm, at least JLR confirmed, that the Range Rover Sport will still be called the Range Rover Sport. So the Range Rover Sport Coupe doesn't have a proper name yet.
I can't believe they're trying to cram yet another Range Rover model into that line.
Well, I like the idea of having the Range Rover Sport available in both two doors and four. I mean, that's kind of cool, but you're right. It's like, what is that doing that the Evoque isn't already doing?
Right.
It's not competing with the BMW X6.
Who cares?
Apparently Land Rover.
Every Land Rover is better than any BMW, so it's like, what's the competition?
Excellent questions. JLR believes it is the BMW X6.
Be cheaper just to point out all the failings of the BMWs and move on.
Harold will get his opportunity to buy one of these and put down 90,000 pounds.
Yeah, I don't think I'll be in first in line for that.
Also released was the Land Rover Discovery 5 pricing. That's the new Disco. U.S. and U.K. pricing was released. I don't think we had that the last time we talked. And the U.K. Version will be out in spring of 2017. The U.S. is going to be out in mid-2017. And U.S. prices are going to start at $49,990. And that will get you an SE 3-liter V6. And if you want a diesel, which is good to see that they have diesel listed in here, but that will start at $58,950 and go all the way up into the $70,000 range. Comparable to the UK pricing, the Discovery S will start at £43,495. And you're starting to go at the top of the line, you're going to go into £70,000 range.
So it sounds like it's a little more than a Discro 4, but not ridiculously more.
No, that's it. Yeah, I think that's right in the same line as before. Although the diesel seems a little hefty in price, but
But diesel often can be a premium upgrade price. It's a more expensive engine to make. I mean, you go to any other brand that offers diesel, and it's a $10,000 option.
Yeah, it's for a diesel upgrade, it's pretty affordable compared to the other makes and models.
Not a true news item, but just something interesting that you may want to check out if you don't have the opportunity to go to the UK and do the Land Rover experience. Autoblog has a series called The List, and it's like 1,001 things that every driver should do, in their life. And this one is drive a Land Rover Defender. And so they went to Esnor Castle, where one of the Land Rover experiences are, and they drove the latest Heritage version of the Defender. And it's, if you don't have the money or the opportunity to go, it's a nice short 10-minute video. You can see what happens there. Take a look at a little bit of the castle, a little bit of the trails that they have, and check out the truck. You're not really going to learn anything spectacular that you probably already didn't know, but it certainly is an interesting video into that experience. Plus, they also take a SVR Range Rover on the track, which was pretty quick, pretty badass. So check that out. We'll have, of course, a link in the show notes for that story and all the others we talk about. And finally, Autocar put together a story called New Land Rover Defender Will Be Brand's Most High-Tech Car Yet. And again, this is Autocar, and it's a really good article. We're going to spend some time on it. This is our last news item today, or this month. And we'll spend some time on it because it kind of brings together a lot of things that have been talked about the new Defender and some of the things that maybe haven't haven't heard before or maybe haven't been confirmed, although I can't say that really much in here is 100% confirmed, except that there is going to be a new Defender. So I'm going to scan the story, and there's a lot to it. This is a still encourage you to go out and take a look at the story yourself and take a look and take a it's a good read, especially if you're interested in the new Defender and what's coming. They apparently at the Paris Auto Show, they talked to Ralph Spaeth, which is the JLR CEO. I talked to him, and he did indicate that they have been testing Defender mules, which he says are very promising, and that the styling also complete, barring a few details, looks quote unquote fantastic. And so that's out there and ongoing, and they are currently testing, which I think we've heard before, but it's good to hear again that they have mules out there and they're being tested. Part of the delay, they think, in getting a new Defender out is part of the business case for making a new Defender, because the old model that we all love sold about 20,000 units a year, and it's believed that they need to sell 50,000 units to make it profitable for them to move ahead. So they need to figure out a way to make that 30,000 unit jump. And they think while they're figuring that part out and making that business case, that's one of the reasons why there was a delay in canceling the old model. They've extended production a few times. And then there's also this now what will end up being a 3-year gap before the new model comes out. Because I think originally they were trying to shoot for, 2018 for that'll be the 70th anniversary to release the new one. But I think that's pushed back now another year. You know, originally, they thought the ideal launch date was going to be 2015. But as you know, that has all been pushed back. And there's still going to be this three-family or pillar philosophy. You're going to have your Defender, your Disco, your Range Rover. And it looks like this article also mentions that there's going to be a baby Defender. So I guess there's going to be a Defender, maybe a Defender and a Defender Sport. Is that going to be the name? Don't know. Maybe they'll have a Defender Sport Coupe too. I don't know. Thank you. There will be it's only mentioned once that there's going to be this baby Defender, and I've not heard that before. So I don't know if that means is that like a 90 and a 110? Will the 110 be the main Defender we know, and then it'll be a 90, and we'll call that the baby one? I don't know.
Well, I was going to say the 90 was always the Sport Coupe.
So true.
I just want to go around saying, yes, that's my Land Rover Defender Sport Coupe.
Well, you can call it anything you want. No problem. When you get your 110 done, you can import a 90, and that'll be your Sport Coupe.
So Spaeth also confirmed that the new Defender would be based on the aluminum architecture of the Range Rover Sport and Discovery, meaning it can share the all-aluminum body shop and final assembly procedures of these models.
Yeah, how could it not at this point?
Right. There's no going back for them.
Right.
No, and in order to sell enough units and make it profitable and make it so that they don't have to sell 200,000 units, they've got to use common platform.
Right. Or end up having to have a separate tooling line to create something different.
So that's what I'm saying. If they were going to do something different, they would have to then sell 200,000 of them just to recoup the cost of the extra production facility.
Maybe they could get those 250 people back then.
Okay, well, there'd be that. Of course, that may happen anyway, just by ramping up production of the new Defender.
Sure.
Yep.
The Defender structure would need, quote, a lot of different elements, unquote, to deliver the extremes of strength and durability customers can expect for a capable off-roader. So Spaeth said here, quote, "It was one of the saddest moments of my career to end production of the old Defender, so we're working very hard to give it an authentic successor."
Well, it's good to hear that they're trying that hard.
Yes, and it looks like they're going to have producing both a civilized and hardcore version of the model. Not sure exactly yet what that means, but it does make some sense. You've kind of seen that in the current versions. They love selling you the add-ons and the bolt-ons and all the gear. So I suspect that there'll be the civilized entry level, if you will, Defender, and then it'll probably be a more of a hardcore version that's off-road capable.
Well, that kind of hints at the whole product family thing, too.
And, the Defender is always going to compete more with, Jeep and Toyota, and they have similar, structuring for their models.
Some of the thought, because of the low volume compared to the other models that will need to be built and sold, this may be produced at the new Slovakia plant. That they're building, because production costs, manufacturing costs should be lower
Cheaper labor.
Yes, although, you know, Brexit may also potentially change that decision.
Yeah, we'll still be seeing how that plays out.
Yeah, I suspect they've had to rethink a whole lot of things since June of last year, or June of this year, I guess you should say.
Oh, yeah, that was this year. Yeah,
this past June.
And the aluminum construction should gives plenty of clues to a mechanical layout. Longitudinal front mounting of the engine was always considered likely, along with a separate transfer case offering high and low range gear sets. But until now, that fact had not been confirmed. The suspension is likely to be a version of the Discovery Range Rover all-independent setup with steel springs, as in the entry-level versions of the outgoing Discovery 4. And Defender looks certain to use the four-cylinder versions of the Ingenium engine, which is being made at the new plant they have in Wolverhampton. There's probably going to be a diesel and a petrol option because they're going to be able to expand finally back in the U.S. market.
And not just the U.S., also Asia tends to use standard petrol over diesel.
That's the advantage of the Ingenium. It's easy to swap back and forth. It's a fairly standard architecture between the two versions.
And finally, 2 years. I'll read this because it's a good little read here, this last paragraph. But 2 years out, there's no word on prices. But Land Rover has been good at charging for premiumness and has become used to hiking its prices with little penalty. Experts predict a starting price of around £35,000 for the Defender, with most examples selling for £40,000 plus. And anyone who wants a cheaper model will have to wait for the rumored baby Land Rover, which isn't expected for at least 3 years. So that's the kind of the summary of the of information that is on the new Defender.
I certainly look forward to seeing what it actually looks like, what its real capabilities are, what its final costs are. We're living in interesting times for vehicles like what was the Defender.
I mean, in many ways, the Defender was you know, out of date probably 15 years ago. You know,
and it was out of date when it first launched.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
That was the best thing about it.
You mean the Series 1? Is that what you're talking about?
Even the Defender. I mean, the Series truck was built on outdated technology, and they continued that tradition all the way through the Defender. That was part of what made it a Defender, was that it was behind the times and still relevant.
What's the phrase? Does important things for important people?
Yeah, something like that.
All right. Well, we continue our Defender watch here on the show. As you know, we're very excited to see what will come. Some of us less excited. And but there we go. So that's check that article out. Go ahead and take a read. And if you have any comments on it yourself, go ahead and send it back to us on the show. And that's the news for this month. Coming up on the rest of the show, we have two guests this month. Our first guest is going to be Ryan with Off-Road Trail Guide. It is a crowdsourced database of off-road trails and OHV parks here in North America. And our guests following Ryan are the Foremans. That's Alec, Jan, and Charles. They wrote a book called Strangers Like Angels. It's about their journey that they took in their series truck back in 1977 from the UK all the way to Nepal. A little preview. Alec is badass, and you'll find out why when you come to that interview.
That's Mr. Badass to you.
Exactly. I met both of those guests. I met at the Overland Expo, and they were actually in the author's booth right next to each other. All right, now on with the show. Was at Overland Expo, as you know, East Overland Expo East, and in the author tent, Ryan was demoing the Off-Road Trail Guide, which is a crowdsourced database of off-road trails and OHV parks in the U.S. Welcome to the show, Ryan.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me. Nice meeting you at the Expo.
Yeah, that was cool. It was worth my time going down to check things out and got to see this. I'm surprised no one has done this before. They probably have. It's just this is a the first opportunity, or first one I've seen, which is, gives you the trails that are available in the U.S., and it's in a crowdsourced database. So what is it, and how'd you come up with the idea?
So I'm relatively new to the off-road hobby. I started about 3 years ago, got my truck, did all my research, and then I'm like, okay, let's go.
And I should pause you, Ryan. We should tell our listeners, You're in the Land family, but not really the Land Rover family. Which that's okay. We're going to give you a pass, and because you have a cool app.
Okay,
awesome. Land Cruiser, right?
I married into the Land Cruiser family. I have a Toyota 4Runner myself.
Oh,
so
cool.
I actually, bought the truck and because I needed the SUV utility, and lo and behold, I found myself doing too much digging on the internet and kind of learned about the hobby and got sucked into it, and then
So you're like all the
it's all downhill from there.
Exactly, you're like everybody else. Yeah.
Exactly, you get that adventure bug in it. You just can't shake it off. So I was planning my first big trip, and was really frustrated with how information was all over the internet, and either on forums or blogs or websites or in books or just talking to people and hearing about their awesome trips, and having to dig all that stuff up manually was very tedious, very time consuming. I was actually planning a trip to Colorado with a group of people, and found myself doing a lot of the work because I was I'm very tech savvy. Google and I are best friends, so I was just scouring the internet and realized this was way too difficult. And why isn't there a single resource for 90% of the information I was looking for, and that involved where to ride, what the terrain is like in different parts, and I started putting together this idea of really actually we started off as like idea for my own trip, and then after spending a few weeks on it, I'm like, well, why don't I share this? And so everyone can do this. And it's just slowly evolved over the last year into, a public database of where to ride. So
it's very, very cool. It is, you can do trip planning, you have custom maps, you can download the maps for, which I think is the big question would be you can download maps for offline use, because that would certainly be the big concern, is you're out in the trail somewhere, cell service isn't the best, or you're down to one bar, or your battery's, you're maybe only on battery and you don't want to use up all your battery. So you can download maps for that. Do you download them? You decide you're going into an area, going into Pennsylvania, and you're going to download all the maps from Pennsylvania. Is that how that works?
Oh, well, right. So that's the biggest, differentiator, from, any of your listeners that are just hearing about Off-Road Trail Guide, is that I've taken a different approach. You don't download like a map of this area, like a map of a certain national park, or you don't pay for individual map. Everything is all inclusive. So really you're just downloading a section of the world, and the trails inside of it. So if you're, like you said, going to Western Pennsylvania, you would just, zoom into the area you want to go and click a button, and it saves everything for offline in one fell swoop. Or if you're going to multiple places, you can just download multiple areas, and the other big differentiator is the maps get more detailed as you zoom in versus traditional, like everyone probably knows of PDF maps. Mm-hmm. And those are just like a scan, a single piece of paper that you're just zooming in on. Nothing gets more detailed as you zoom in. So this is pretty much, kind of loosely based off the Google Maps platform. As you zoom in, you start seeing more roads and terrain detail and stuff like that. That really helps you kind of visualize where you are within, an area you've never been.
So what what data do you actually get, and where do you get the data from? So obviously you get Google, but I suspect you have other sources that you pull in.
I started off basically scouring the web for individual roads that I was, interested in Colorado, and just started collecting that list. But then I thought bigger, and then I actually found the U.S. Forestry Service's all their what they call motor vehicle use trails. So if you're familiar with MVUM maps, those are maps that, they've got a geospatial information systems GIS database of all the Forestry Service roads. And they publish MVUM maps for all the national forests that are where vehicles are allowed. So instead of someone having to go and download all those maps, I've imported all that data into Off-Road Trail Guide. So you literally just zoom in and the trails start appearing on the map. And so I've imported all that data, and I feel like I talked to a lot of people at Overland Expo, and they're like, where's all the East Coast data? And I'm still working on that. The West Coast does. The Western states are doing it right, and they must share their database. Share the state data must be shared with the national data somehow. You know, I've got a national forest here in South Carolina where I live, where there are forest service roads, but for whatever reason, they're not in the national database that I sync with. So, you know, I just need to work with either the states or the Fed on figuring out where that data is, so we can more easily map these. And that's just like the initial data set that I've imported, and then people can use the app or the website really to add trails and routes that that they know and they're familiar with. And that's kind of where the crowdsourcing piece comes in, is where people start, you know, adding their own reviews and rating, you know, difficulty ratings and pictures to all the trails that they've done, to share that with the next person that's doing research on where to go for the weekend or the week or the month. And that, you know, that next person has that much more information, you know, about where they're going and what they need to bring and what they're going to experience, so they can just be better prepared. And, you know, instead of sitting at home wondering where you can go, you can actually get out there and do the exploring.
So this includes the public roads that are typically, I'm guessing, federal and state. Does this also include private parks and private areas?
Right now I have Windrock Park in Tennessee and Hawk Pride Mountain in Alabama. And, you know, those are private OHV parks. And the goal is to find the time to import more. I need to work with more off-road parks because I'm sure they have the GPS trail data for their systems. So as more off-road parks hear about the app, you know, instead of them printing a bunch of paper maps and handing them out to people, they can, you know, give me the data. I'll import it. I'll actually can give them the ability to update the trails on the fly. Because if you've ever been to an OHV park, you might be looking at a map from, you know, early in the season or perhaps last year's season because they printed too many and the trails moved or got updated. And, you know, that's a lot of the cost for them. So
that's actually a cool feature.
Yeah.
Having live data.
Exactly. Yeah. Actually, yeah. Live data, you know, and then people can just, you know, download the offline maps and know exactly where they, you know, where they are within the park too.
Yeah. There's several in Pennsylvania you should look into. Rausch Creek. And the other two just went out of my head. Guys, what's the other two?
We need Dave.
Yeah, we do need Dave. Oh, anyway, so we'll get to I'll mention this to you later as we remember them, Ryan. But I know Rausch Creek comes to mind, and it used to be Paragon, but they're out of business. Why can't I think of the other two? I know there's two more in Pennsylvania. They're out there than the eastern side of PA, mainly central and east. But
well, if we had them in Off-Road Trail Guide, you could just bring up the website and they're right there.
They're right there, exactly. Absolutely.
You know, if anyone's, you know, traveling up through the area and they're just, you know, like got the off-road itch, they can just, you know, check the app or website real quick and figure out, you know, what's around them, how much the place costs per day, and if there's camping available and stuff like that. So I built this to basically help people find where to go and, you know, help them get out there easier.
Can you add your own, you know, there's some trails here where near where we are that's all private. Is there the ability to add my own private trail to the map and that would maybe be only visible to me or a select group of people?
Yes. So right now you can record a trail within the app. And it's most of our data syncs to the cloud if you so choose. So if you recorded the trail, you know, to the gas station just to test it out, that would be saved to your personal like account. And that's really all you can do with it right now. I've got a huge overhaul app version coming out beginning of January for iOS and then probably February for Android, which is just going to be a huge release of features. But the intent is you record a trail and you can send it to your friends. It's like a private link kind of like you make a private YouTube video, same kind of thing where if they have the link, they can see the trail. And then, that way you can keep it private. And then it, by default, it is private. And then, for people that, want to contribute to the crowdsource database, they can submit it for approval. And, basically we have this system where we'll have, state sponsors. So you or anyone else, I would need some money for Pennsylvania cause I don't have one yet, but, essentially, a new trail would come in Pennsylvania, and then I'd look at it and be like, okay, this looks good. Send it to the state sponsor. And that person is really just the sponsor, for that state to verify that it's a legal trail. It's not on private property. Cause the last thing we want to do is, people just upload all this, illegal roads and, give us a bad name, give the hobby a bad name and, get stuff shut down. Cause I know, lobbyists are very eager for excuses to, shut down access for us. So, just a little bit of,
nice,
oversight to, kind of, keep everyone.
You answered one of my questions. So now I can't answer that question.
That was my question too. What are you doing to authenticate? But I like what you're doing.
Yeah, that's a great solution to have someone local who can go out and verify. And I'm in Vermont, so we have a lot of former public rights of access for old roads that may not actually exist anymore, but they're still legal roads. So we have all sorts of maps. But like you said, with a number of the states you're running into, they're not all published, at least not digitally. They may be PDF only, so no direct import. So it's nice to be able to have someone local who can go back to those sorts of resources and verify that everything's legal, go check it out, make sure there's no trespassing signs posted or anything like that. That's cool.
I like the idea of an on-site reality check.
Agreed. Nothing like going on a long trip, showing up somewhere and finding you can't actually go take the trail.
Yeah, and that's where people can leave reviews. So if they go run a trail, they can, use in the app, they can just say, ran this trail, it was great. I think the difficulty was like a 4 or yeah, there was a tree down halfway, don't waste your time kind of thing. So, live reviews of people that have gone on it recently. So before you trek, a couple hours out of your way, you're not going to be wasting your time too. It's also important. But in all, I hope that by having a resource where people find trails easier and are more aware of them, I hope that awareness breeds good things for the hobby too. Maybe people would kind of band together for cleanups or anything else that they can think of to kind of expand and promote the hobby too. So kind of leaving a lot of power in the people to kind of take it where they can.
So presently the app is only available for the US, but you are, because we've talked previously, you're looking to expand to the rest of the world, right?
Yeah. So essentially, it's worldwide capable because there's no concept. I don't have to create maps. It's already worldwide. People can record a trail anywhere in the world. And technically submit it. And, I guess if someone submitted something from Africa, I would be like, okay, add. I definitely learned at Overland Expo more about the people that have gone on some serious overlanding trips and wanting to talk and, share their adventure. So the next phase that I'm working on right now with the Off-Road Trail Guide project as a whole is not just trails, not just OHV parks, but overland routes as well. So I keep seeing online people posting 750-mile route through Maine. You hearing more about these backcountry byways, Kentucky Adventure Trails, these kind of scenic routes that are mostly overland that people are putting together with waypoints along the way where you can stop and either camp or hike or, see this or that. The next phase of the project is to have people kind of create like a pro- profile for this adventure that they went on so that they can share it more easily with other people. So, you know, for instance, you can just be sitting on the couch on like a Wednesday night, just, you know, flicking through all the adventures you can go on within 200 miles of your house. And then you can, you know, just poke your wife or significant other and just be like, hey, honey, you want to do this? And just flick through and show her the pictures real quick and kind of hopefully have some extra visual encouragement to get out there as well.
So you've done this for yourself in order to encourage your wife to let you go out, right?
How did you know?
Because you just told us. No, it's actually very cool. And I mean, it's certainly overlanding to make that kind of distinction between off-roading and overlanding. I think most people kind of understand that. I think having that capability also is very interesting. As you know, the Bells are traveling the world, friends of the show, and they're traveling the world in their Defender 130. They're currently in Florida, but I can see them kind of using an app somewhere to track their journey because they're going to have their truck shipped to the UK and then drive all the way out to Asia and back or something. They're not sure where yet exactly, but that could be nice to track that
journey. Yeah, I hope to have in the next in the next year, it's kind of hard to predict your timeline that far out, but I do hope to have some kind of feature where the people that do go on those, you know, mega epic adventures, they can somehow, you know, if they probably already have a blog or, you know, they have something that or Facebook that they're advertising their adventure on. I do hope to kind of help that make that process easier for people to follow. You know, maybe it's just, you know, a website for them where, you know, if they were uploading GPS and waypoint stuff, you know, people can follow along and see that as well. So definitely I have a lot of stuff that I want to do.
Isn't your full-time job?
Of course not.
It's not paying for itself.
Oh, it's we just launched in I've been working on it for about a year. We launched in June of this year. I guess I'll mention that there is a subscription for $10 a year, and it's a free app to download, but you automatically get, you know, 90% of the features. The one feature that is a subscription is the GPS data kind of at like full zoom. So I want people to be able to use the app and website to find the trails and, you know, as you zoom in and pan around on the map, trails will load on the fly. But if you want to zoom in far enough to pretty much where you can use the app for navigation and like see where you are, zoomed in far enough to where you can see, you know, where you are on the trail, that's where the subscription comes into play. So if you want to use the app on the trail, that's when you'll need a subscription. But everything else is free for people to play around with and basically, find adventure.
But $10 a year, that's all?
Hey, you gotta start somewhere.
No, I think that's cheap.
That's very reasonable. I could see the other business model is that it's free to get you out on the trail, but then if you want to get home, that's when you pay.
Ooh. Didn't think about that.
Full detail to halfway out to wherever your destination is.
Enough to get you lost.
Yeah. Once it detects that you're been out of cell coverage for 8 hours and you're pretty much or maybe you haven't moved in maybe an hour, so it's like, oh, maybe he broke his truck at the same time, then that's when it like shuts off. Yeah, that would be pretty mean.
So I've got one question relating to, you know, users submitting their own trails and maps. You mentioned you can record trails as you take them, as you drive. Do you have other methods for importing data for people who want to submit trails?
Yes. So we have, I've tried to mock the website up just like Google My Maps, if you're familiar with it. There's a couple other websites that are similar. But we have a create a map tool on the website where if you already have GPS data from previous trips or, you know, wherever, you can import GPX, KML, GeoJSON, any of those GPS type files. You can just drag and drop them onto our map, and it automatically converts it for you and drops the line on the map for you. So that would be like how you add one trail, and then you could submit it. Or going back to our previous comment that John made, yes, you can build your own custom map So let's say you're going on a custom trip with some buddies for a three-day weekend, and you want to kind of pre-plan where you're going to go, you can use the Create Map Builder to drop many trails, drop lots of waypoints, drop your campsites. You know, you can kind of do everything that you can do on Google My Maps in terms of creating your own custom map. You can do all that on the website, save it, and like I mentioned earlier, we kind of have like a cloud, and essentially it would sync through the cloud back to your device. So there's no transferring of files either, because when I was planning my trips earlier, I just like, wow, transferring all these files back and forth between the phone was also very painful. So I wanted to make it easier for everyone.
You know, there's a there's a off-road trail that goes coast to coast. Well, it used to go coast to coast, and motorcycle riders would use it. Land Rover just ran it, what, last year in or maybe 2 years ago now in Disco 4s? That would be an interesting trail.
You're talking about the Trans-American Trail?
I think that's
yeah.
Is that the
that's
one?
That's the one.
Yeah.
TAT. Yes, yeah, so I have the GPS files for that. You can find them online if you just Google it, I guess. But, yeah, I will – that is such a long trail that I'm trying to figure out how to incorporate it into the app. When I do figure that out, and it'll probably be part of the kind of the overland routes that I'm building into the app now, so it'll probably be part of that. Essentially, yes, that would be such an awesome thing to have to visualize, because yeah. Once you see it, you're like, whoa, I want to do that.
I was even thinking some of the historical journeys that have been taken. Yeah, there's several trips that have gone from the UK to Singapore and Nepal that people have taken, a couple of very famous ones. We know folks that have transited through South America several times. That kind of be interesting to see maybe some of the more more historical ones of significance.
Right. And if you're a newbie like me, and it's just inconceivable, like how that, you know, how you would do that and what route you would take. As people do those and share those, it would help kind of promote that these things are possible and they've been done before. And here's some pictures along the way. And you can see like we'll have geotag pictures. So, you can see exactly where in the world that picture was taken. So, you know what you're getting yourself into.
Right. Right. Did you talk to the other folks in the tent there, the Alec and Jan Foreman, the Explore More and Strangers Like Angels?
Yeah. We were right next to each other in the booth there, and got to know them quite well over the 3 day weekend there. So I see they're on the show later.
Yes, there are other guests this month, and I could definitely see that would kind of be interesting to see their journey on a map. I mean, they have a map, but it's, you can't zoom in on it from the book, but just something I thought of as we were talking.
Well, say hey to them for me. I talked to Jan and her son Charles a lot at the expo.
Yeah, well, inside baseball stuff. We've recorded that like 2 weeks ago, so
we'll jump in our time machine.
Yes, I'll call Dr. Who. Well, Ryan, I want to thank you for coming on the show and joining us today to talk about the off-road trail guide. Sounds really cool. I've downloaded it. I'm going to use it I'll be using it come summertime when I take my overland journey, and I'm looking forward to the overland aspects of your app. So remind everybody again where they can get it, how much it costs, and what platforms it's on.
Well, it's available in the app stores today for iOS and Android. And you can also check out our website, offroadtrailguide.com.
And apparently you live near an airport.
Thought you might hear that.
Either that or there's an incoming strike you might want to be aware of.
Yeah, we live 15 minutes from the airport here.
So. They've located your position.
They used his app.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm going to leave this in the show, so go ahead and tell us, tell everybody again where I want to leave it in. That's great.
It's, you can check us out on their website, offroadtrailguide.com. You can do everything you can do in the app on the website. Scroll around on the map, watch trails load on the fly, so you can really get that visual of where you want to go. We're in the iOS and Android app stores. That's free to download and play around with it. Find where you want to go. There is a $10 a year subscription for those that want to use their app to as like a GPS to see exactly where they are on the trails, make sure you don't make any wrong turns, and kind of visualize your terrain. So that would be the $10 a year subscription. And just a reminder, it is a crowdsourced system. So while we may not have your trail that you're looking for or trail that you've heard of, feel free to go out, run some trails, and record them with the app and submit them to us. And we'll approve it so everyone else can get the added benefit of exploring.
Well, Ryan, as you know, we have listeners around the world, Australia, Africa, and Europe. I suspect you might be getting some folks submitting some things from the rest of the world.
Well,
I hope you're ready.
I think come January, there's going to be a big app release for iOS, and come February for Android. And I'm pretty sure that one I can click a few buttons and enable for worldwide app store distribution. The only thing is I'll have to hire or have some people volunteer to translate the app if it's going to be in a different language. Of course, people are probably listening to your podcast in English, so I shouldn't have to worry about that.
At this point, yes. We don't do any translating.
If any of our listeners don't know English, they ain't getting much out of the show.
Gotcha.
And I recommend that everybody go out to offroadtrailguide.com. You can sign up for updates on the new features that are coming out. You can enter your email address there, even if you don't want to take a look and use the app yet, especially if you're maybe in Australia. I'm talking to you, Oren, maybe you want to sign up and see what's going on before you take the dive. So go out to offroadtrailguide.com, search the both app stores for Offroad Trail Guide, and you can download the app. Thanks again, Ryan. We appreciate you coming to the show, talking about your app. I think it's fantastic. It's much needed, and I know I will be using it.
Yeah, I look forward to your feedback after your overland trip there, and anyone else's feedback for that matter on how I can make the digital experience of exploring easier. All right, guys. Thanks for letting me be on the show.
Welcome back to the Zendersteer Podcast. Our guest this month have written a book called Strangers Like Angels, and they explored Europe and Asia back in 1977 in a 1974 Series 3. So joining us from Richmond, Virginia is Charles, Jan, and Alec. And Jan and Alec, you're the ones that actually did the driving, and Charles, you came later, right?
Yep, I was a star in the sky when they did this trip.
So, Charles, I met you guys at the Overland Expo back in early October, and I know you guys have a nice book, and you have a whole website dedicated to the book and to other activities around exploring called Explore More. So why don't you start us off, tell us what the brand, I guess, is all about. I guess that's the new thing in the world is branding yourself, right?
Yeah, so Explore More is a brand that I've created that I've been inspired by my own parents. And as I've gotten into the overland industry and Land Rovers and that, as I've gotten into a place where I can afford such things, I've created this brand to inspire the next generation to do exactly what my parents did in 1977. So it's an adventure lifestyle brand with a passion to inspire people to explore the world, engage with others, and embrace global cultures, which is exactly what they did. Explore More is inspired by their book, Strangers Like Angels with a Devil or Two to Boot, and it's written by my parents, Alec and Jan Foreman, which tells the story of their overland adventure in 1977. With only maps and a compass, they drove their 1974 Land Rover Series 3, which was a long wheel based, and they still own it today, 40 years later. And they drove it 40,000 miles through 29 countries in Europe, Africa, and Asia. And on their journey, they experienced the delights of rugged landscapes, including the majestic dunes of the Sahara Desert, which they drove across twice, again, with only maps and a compass. Then they went on to experience the extensive valleys of Iran and Afghanistan prior to major changes there. And then finally, they parked their overland rig at the highest point and the highest road in the world in Ladakh, before returning back to England, which is where we're all from. So they definitely had a lifetime's worth of exciting challenges and stunning views. However, what truly was sort of the take back from their journey was the warm hospitality that they met from the many strangers along the trip, many of which, as the title implies, were like angels who guided them along the way on this journey. So today they sort of are on a new adventure, trying to share their story through their book, Strangers Like Angels, with a Devil or Two to Boot. And Explore More is a brand that I've created that sort of encompasses that story and is trying to inspire the next generation to go and do exactly that. So
I think it's a very laudable goal and an excellent idea. There's certainly a lot of, that's what the Overland Expo showed. There's a lot of people, especially in the United States, starting to understand what overlanding is and wanting to get out and about and tour and drive around. And as you know, the Bells were just at my home, and they're also exploring the world and overlanding and doing the same thing. So how did it all start? Let's when we go back to the beginning, what was the genesis for, hey, let's travel the world in a 1974 Series 3? Well,
mind you, in 1977, that wasn't like a big thing. That wasn't like an old truck. It was just...
That's true. It was brand new.
It was what they had to drive.
Showroom finish.
Well, going back even further, back to the days when I was serving in the British Army as a helicopter engineer in the Royal Electrical and Mechanical Engineers, motor transport were probably Series 2 Land Rovers, and then the military version where we'd go off and rescue helicopters that had either force landed or needed extra repairs. From a workshop level, and it was, I guess that's where my love of these machines began. And then meeting my Jan in northern Germany, right from the beginning, we talked about doing travel on an extended basis, you know, where you didn't have to get back to work. So we bought our very own Series 3 Land Rover, which had begun its life with my uncle carrying around pigs and potatoes. Our first task in the modification of the vehicle was to get rid of the smell. But from then we built in an elevating roof and sleeping accommodation, storage, security devices, and we were all set for our adventure.
Come on, you never got rid of the pig smell.
Well,
admit it.
Got rid of most of it.
Because pigs are awful.
Not as bad as monkeys and chickens, but...
I think pigs might be worse.
I had a job once where I had for the summer, I worked with lab animals, and I can tell you, monkeys and chickens are worse than pigs.
Fair enough. So you started, Alec, in a Series 2... This is like, that's cool stuff, you know. That's fodder for the podcast here. That was, you drove one, and I know it wasn't the Royal Engineers. I should have written down what you served with, and I apologize.
The Electrical and Mechanical Engineers, looking after the Army Air Corps helicopters, and we were their kind of mobile workshop where they got them in trouble or needed help. We would drive out from our workshop base. With new gearbox, engine, blades, whatever was required. And as I say, our mode of transport were these Land Rovers go anywhere, do anything machine.
Did you see conflict during this?
Unfortunately not. At a time, my career was spent in northern Germany. I spent a short period in Northern Ireland, 2 years in Hong Kong, and then had a period of over 3 years in the Antarctic.
Wow.
So they were mobile shops? Did I hear correctly?
Well, they were mainly a means of transport so that we could get into, we needed a vehicle where we could get in, if necessary, cross-country, over rough terrain.
That was in Germany, though, wasn't it?
That was in Germany. We still use them in Hong Kong. The Antarctic was a whole different different thing. Obviously, no Land Rovers down there.
Wait a minute, you spent time in the Antarctic?
That's right.
Damn.
Beautiful place.
How long were you in the Antarctic?
I'm sorry?
How long did you spend in the Antarctic?
We did 3 6-month seasons. We'd fly down, we like migrating birds. We'd fly from UK to Toronto, where the de Havilland Twin Otter aircraft was made. Then we'd do a ferry flight for about a week down through the States, Caribbean, and South America. We'd arrive end of September. We'd then take all the field parties, the scientists and their assistants, out to their work areas, and then keep them supported. They needed more food, more fuel. If they had a husky dog who went lame, we'd fly at a replacement. And we'd continue to do this through to the end of March. And then we'd put the ferry tanks back in and fly back north, and arriving back in Toronto in sometime in April. We'd spend the summer in Europe, and then back to the Antarctic again in September. I did this on three consecutive years.
I mean, doing it once is badass. Three times.
That's about the coolest thing I've heard in quite a while.
Wow.
It was exciting stuff. We had some exciting moments, but that's another story.
But no Land Rovers down there.
No Land Rovers.
I can't imagine having to hand crank a series truck on the Antarctic.
No. Any mechanical vehicles at all that they, because I know they have planes, but did they take any
had my main transport that I was involved with was skidoos.
Okay. Gotcha.
Snowmobiles.
Nice.
A whole lot of fun driving across between, well, the airstrip and the base, and occasionally they'd guys would take extended trips with these machines out into the Bundu, it was called.
So were you actually driving the Land Rovers as part of your job?
Yeah, that was, again, as I say, back in Hong Kong and Germany, the Land Rover was our main means of transport.
So you were like a well-seasoned professional at handling a Land Rover before you even began your journey.
Yeah, that's right. I'd had lots of experience, and even in UK, I've had some army training specialist courses out on Salisbury Plain, which is one of the British Army's biggest training areas,
right,
where we've done have lots of fun diving in and out of mud holes, steep slope recovery, all the kind of tricks of looking after and driving a Land Rover.
That's where they teach you which hammer to bash it with, right?
That's right, something like that. And it was during that time that the kind of desire to go on a real adventure out to some of the wilder areas in the world. And we, Jan and I, right from the beginning, planned this trip, which took us in Europe, Africa, and Asia.
Did you know about the original first overland that the Cambridge and Oxford gentlemen had done?
Yeah, I'd read up on some of that, been inspired by some of the early trips that had gone out through Burma and out to on down through Malaysia, Singapore, and on to Australia. But that was quite a while ago.
Now, did that give you the inspiration and the idea to do your journey, or was it just, hey, you decide that on your own, you and Jan?
Yeah, it was pretty much decided on our own. Jan and I just felt that we wanted to do this trip.
And why, I guess why Asia? I mean, you could certainly, did you do it all in one fell swoop? Did you decide that you wanted to go as far as you possibly could overland?
When we set out, with a forever schedule. You know, we were not, it was limited by funds, I guess, but we thought maybe we would find work on the way, and we'd just keep going for as long as we could. So we left England in February in the winter and crossed over into Europe, came down through Germany, into France and Spain, and then we crossed the Mediterranean to go to Morocco. And after seeing many of the familiar tourist places like Casablanca, Marrakesh, and Fez, we ventured up onto the coast of Algeria and then turned south and began the journey towards the Sahara Desert. And on that time, we were mostly traveling on our own. But the very first part of the desert, we teamed up with a couple who were driving in a Ford Dormobile van, camper van. And we just traveled with them for a couple of days while we were all getting used to driving through the desert where there was no identifiable road.
Wait a minute. You're on the Sahara, no identifiable road, and you're probably not traveling at night, I'm guessing. So you're not going to use the stars. Are you using what tools are you using?
Well, we had a map, a Michelin map of North Africa, and we had a compass. And as we drove along, I regularly took compass readings, the mileage. I looked for identifiable interesting things around, whether that be on the terrain, like blue-coloured rocks or certain foliage and so on.
Sure.
So that at any point we thought we were not in the right direction, we could backtrack. So this was I was doing this as we were driving along, writing in a little notebook.
Wow. You could be a Pittsburgher because, you know, around here in Pittsburgh, we give directions by where things used to be. off topic, but I had a new job in a place called Greensburg, and I found out where GB's used to be because people in that area told me, you need to go where GB's used to be. Anyway, sounds familiar. So you were using landmarks and a compass to get around.
It's the way it's been done for hundreds of years before we had these little electronic toys to play with.
And satellites bouncing around the skies. Yeah. Right. Any major problems? Did you get lost?
Did you break stuff?
We crossed did the first crossing of the Sahara incident-free. Our first trouble was on an absolutely diabolical, what had been a tarmac road in Nigeria. In fact, there was a British construction company in the process of building a new road alongside. We'd left the previous town some 80 miles behind us, and driving along, we heard a rather loud bang from the rear end of the vehicle, and we stopped and, being British, got out the teapot and had a cup of tea while we considered the problem. And on investigation, we'd actually broken one of the main overload springs on the suspension. We decided that the town ahead of us, was an unknown quantity. We didn't know whether we'd get spares, but we felt pretty sure we'd get them in the town. We'd come through 80 miles back. So we turned around and had gone 3 or 4 miles, and we came across a road accident. Another Land Rover belonging to the road construction company, driven by some local guys who had basically not gone round a corner and impaled themselves on a rather large rock. Fortunately, none of them were badly injured, a few cuts and bruises. We put them in the back of the vehicle, our Land Rover, and they said there's pointed us on, saying, Wimpy Camp, and it was the road camp. We drove in. Jan took them off, the guys off to the medical center, and I was underneath the Land Rover just checking, see if the springs had moved any. And the manager of the project came along and said, asked what we were about, and I said, well, we brought in 3 of your guys from a road accident. He didn't ask how they were. He asked, how's their Land Rover look? I said, well, it didn't look pretty sorry for itself. He said, well, that's the 3rd new Land Rover they've written off in the first month.
Ouch.
He said, what's your problem? I said, oh, I've got a broken spring. He said, oh, no problem. Bring it round the garage. Mechanics will fix it for you overnight. Dinner's at 8, see you in the bar at 6, and tonight's movie night. And so we...
I'm staying in the air-conditioned guest house.
There you go. Yeah.
So we looked after well for evening meal, air-conditioned sleeping accommodation. Next morning we picked up our Land Rover and they put on complete new rear suspension. And they said, take away any spares you want from what we've taken off.
I was going to say, if they've wrecked three of them, there's an opportunity for some spare parts there.
Yeah, so, and they, as we drove, just about to drive away, said, oh, go around to the fueling point and fill up with gas before you leave. So those guys, I guess, were the first angels we met. We're able to put our vehicle back in working order again.
Wow, that's your Algerian tax dollars at work for you, I think.
So tell us about the highest point on the highest road in the world. I was not familiar with that.
When we were, after we'd traveled across Iran, Afghanistan, through Pakistan, when we arrived in India, we were at this time traveling with another couple who were from Switzerland. We teamed up with them in Afghanistan, where we had to drive in convoy across the central route. But we met again in India and drove up to the north to an area called Ladakh. And it's on the border with the China. And it's called Little Tibet because the local people are of Tibetan origin. In the capital of Ladakh, it's called Leh, L-E-H. And there we saw a sign saying to the highest point of the highest road in the world, 18,360 feet. But also we saw a sign to say that you could not actually go to it, no driving beyond this point. But it was too much of a temptation to miss, because especially for Alec, he'd been at the South Pole in the Antarctic, so why not now go to the highest road in the world?
Oh, and if there's a sign saying you can't do it, you know that means you got to do it.
Yeah. So we set off early in the morning with the Swiss couple. And as we drove along, we came across a barrier that was actually up. And there was a little tent on the side, which obviously the guard was sleeping in. And so we drove as fast as we could past this barrier place. And continued up as far as we could until we reached the point of where another big sign was saying to the highest point on the highest road in the world. And at that point, for driving, the Land Rover was doing very...
not very good gas mileage. We were doing about 7 miles to the gallon because the carburetor was not altitude compensated, but a good old Land Rover. That's got up there, even if we were a bit heavy on the gas.
That's about half of what they normally get.
That's right.
And on the way back, the barrier was down, and the soldier was standing there, armed soldier, and he wanted to know where we were going. And we said, well, we're going to Leh, which was the town we'd come from before the journey that morning. And he said, oh, you shouldn't be up here. And we said, well, we won't do it again. You know, we'll just keep going. Yeah. We figured that he would get in more trouble for having us pass when he was sleeping than we would. So we, it was a special morning.
Well, yeah, what's he going to do? It's like, yeah, you've already confiscate your picture. You do have a picture in the book. Highest point on the world's highest road, 18,380 feet. How do you say the name of the town?
Ladakh. Ladakh. Yes, Ladakh is the area, and Leh is the town.
Okay.
The picture on the left, it's got Leh there.
Ah, yeah. Gotcha. And then so there's you and the Swiss couple, and there's a sign there. Looks like October 21st, 1977.
That's correct.
Any sort of world record? Do you own a world record for motorized vehicle or anything? Highest point in the...
I doubt it. But now if you go to that place, it's very, touristy.
Oh.
They have Yeah, it's totally different now. Well,
vehicles can make it there now. They have more, a little more power than they used to.
True. That's pretty cool. Let's go back also. I know it kind of skipped because skipped in your journey because I just like the highest point in the road part. But so you were in the Sahara, and then what happened after the Sahara Desert?
Well, we came down through Niger, Nigeria, Cameroon, and when we were planning to drive east to Kenya and then ship the vehicle to India. But when we were in Cameroon, we checked with the British Embassy the conditions of the countries that we would be driving into. And in Zaire, as it was then, there was fighting. The Kenya-Tanzania border was closed, and Idi Amin was in power in Uganda. So it didn't look a very favorable route to take, and we weren't looking for trouble. So we decided to go west and went back into Nigeria, Benin, Togo, Ghana, Upper Volta, which is now Burkina Faso, and Mali, and then into Niger, and then back up through the Sahara Desert. And that meant we were traveling at a time when it was at the optimum heat. And when you were advised actually not to go through the Sahara.
So, of course, you did.
Well, yeah, I guess we did, because we'd made our choice in Cameroon and we just had to continue on.
Were you traveling alone at that time?
We were traveling on our own.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah. All of that time we were traveling on our own. Yeah.
Sure, sure. And how was that? I mean, that's just the two of you. Did you handle someone handle certain chores? Did you do any of the driving, Jan?
I did initially on the journey. But when we got to the desert and Alec was telling me how to put it into four-wheel drive and do this and get that gear over here and so on. And he said, if you don't get it right, you know, we're going to be stuck here in the desert and so on. And I thought, well, I don't want to be responsible for doing any damage and for Alec having to work in the desert on the vehicle. So I decided that I would be the diary journalist and the navigator. And, yeah, and just generally, you know, the domestic side of things. And that suited us well. We had a good team going.
We made a great team.
Yeah.
And just to throw in there, too, going back to when they did meet in the military, my mom was also in the British Army. She trained as a nurse. So they came well prepared with lots of skills that just naturally fit into their trip. So
hey, one of you fixes the machines and the other one fixes the humans.
Yeah,
that is a good combination. Excellent, excellent. Well, although I am glad to hear that you did drive some. That's nice to hear because it's important,
sure.
And it's good to have your respective skills too. But it's nice to be able to share some of that the driving part.
Yeah, Alec helped with the cooking too. I was quite surprised when I was writing the book and looking at the diaries, and I thought, oh, you did this cooking and you did that fixing that, and that was quite. Surprised.
Well, and also there's another funny story of, you know, when they'd cross the Niger River, they'd have to go and test how deep the water was. So my mom was the one that walked out in croc-infested waters. And
there wasn't any crocodiles in there. Don't exaggerate.
Oh, well, that's what
Jan, tell them there's crocodile-infested waters. It's a wonderful story. It's okay.
In the Chitwan National Park in Nepal, we did go through and crocodile waters to get across, didn't we?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did you use? Did you? I assume you bought local food. You weren't eating rations, right? You didn't bring any military rations.
Well, we did. You know, because you figure there won't be too many supermarkets in the desert, so we did pack 4 months' supply of dried foods, and I did those in 10-day ration packs, which we stored a lot of those in our roof box. And some of the items we had was actually from the Antarctic, which the scientists, when they'd gone out into the wilderness there, there were certain foods, if they didn't use them up, they came back to the base and then people could take them for their camping trips. So we had like small blocks of dehydrated meat, for instance. And we never actually bought any fresh meat along the way. But we would buy, obviously, fresh vegetables and all anything we could find that was of use to make our meals, we would buy as we went along, but we could supplement it with the dried foods when there was any restriction or we wanted just something extra. One of the things we found was dried egg powder, which I hadn't even realized existed. But apparently during the wartime, there was dried egg powder.
Oh, yeah.
And so I resourced that, and that was very useful until we found some chickens along the way.
Well, wait, you had chickens in the truck?
No. Oh.
That's how you get rid of the pig smell.
Yeah.
So you leave Africa and go to Asia. Where did you land in Asia?
Well, we left Africa. On the second crossing of the Sahara, we came up and exited through Tunisia, and we got a ferry across to Sicily, up through Italy, and into Austria, where we kind of regrouped, I guess you'd call it, getting we needed some spare parts out from England and get some more cash sent. And we spent some days in Vienna, Austria, and then moved and set off east through what was then the communist countries of Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, and then into Turkey, and then on out through Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India, and eventually to Nepal.
You just said the magic word, by the way, Bulgaria. It's John's heritage.
My maternal grandmother is, best we know, is from Sofia, Bulgaria.
Oh, okay.
And my,
I'll throw that in the book, too.
Yeah. Oh, good. Definitely. Excellent. Excellent. Yeah. That's all we really know. But my grandfather was from Macedonia, which, of course, was Yugoslavia at the time. But
yeah.
Yeah. Good stuff. Good stuff. Before we continue with that, I have to ask this, and it sounds like one of the impersonal questions. Too personal of a question. How old were you guys when you started this?
I was, 24 or 25?
24.
Yeah. 24. Alec was
4 years older.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow. Okay, that's just more impressive. You guys are badass. You really are. And how long did you spend in Africa? Like, how long did that time take that you were out, the first leg of the journey?
It would have been February through June, I guess.
Okay, so about five months?
It was August when we set off from Hungary, Vienna.
Okay.
August. Yeah. So from February through to end of July, we were on that first part of the journey.
Nice. So the second part of the journey, so you take a little bit of break, sounds like about a month or so, and you regroup and fix the rover and or a landy, depending on what side of the pond you're on, and then you get back going again.
That's correct. And then one of the most exciting parts of our journey was traveling through Afghanistan. And when we arrived in Herat, to the west of the country, we did a lot of wild camping as such. But when we were in any major town, then obviously we found where the overlanders would park up. And that was at the back of a hotel. And we were there chatting to some of the other folk, and we discovered that we could not continue. Well, we didn't know too much about Afghanistan, but we found that there was the tarred road went from Herat north to Mazar Sharif and then down again to Kabul, like in a diamond shape. And then the other half of the diamond would go south from Herat, Kandahar, and then north east to Kabul. But we discovered that it's possible to drive through the central route where there is no tarred road. It's just rough driving the whole way. But you couldn't do it without being in convoy, and that's when we linked up with the Swiss couple.
It was something like a 1,000-kilometer drive through real Land Rover territory.
It definitely sounds like real Land Rover territory.
As in no roads required?
No roads required. Yeah, that's the number plate you need, no road required. That's the number plate on the back of my 109. Afghanistan, this is 2 years before the Soviets invade in 1979. So that's right before the Soviet invasion.
Well, of course, we didn't know they were going to be invading.
Right.
I don't think anybody did. That's kind of the point.
We just enjoyed the journey that we found. And in fact, in our book, we have several chapters on that part of the journey because it was such an amazing terrain to drive through, some fantastic valleys and rugged driving through riverbeds on rocky, cross rocks and so on. It was really...
really what Land Rovers are built for.
I'm sure it's a beautiful country before it got all shot up.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And very helpful people. We never had any problem with any of the local people we met. We found nothing but kindness.
So what the roads, you mentioned them, how much was tarmac? How much was just, a dusty stone road? Or was it a mix, I assume?
No tarmac.
None, okay.
On the central route, no tarmac.
Okay.
Just rough roads.
Right.
And there's some interesting, all sorts of adventures going through. There's some interesting bridges where you're kind of 30 feet up in the air on a bridge which is built out of tree trunks and split logs spread between the tree trunks. Watch the local market truck drive over and then take a deep breath and edge forward onto the bridge, making sure that there's going to be a camera to record the event, whether you make it or fall into the river.
Yeah.
Well, and to add to that, as far as the camera, I mean, my parents, again, didn't take a digital camera. They took just slide film.
Right.
Every shot they took counted. They had to, they couldn't be blasting away because they'd run out of film. But and just to plug their Instagram feed, if you go to Strangers Like Angels on Instagram, you'll find a plethora of their images that they took. Some really amazing photography. I mean,
they are.
My parents are they're creative people. Photos they took are amazing, and true artistic angles and everything. So I definitely encourage people, if you're on Instagram, check them out. There's lots of great pictures, and we're constantly posting new ones that aren't even included in the book. So in addition to all their photos, and to get some more pictures, I definitely encourage everyone to check out on Instagram. You can go to @strangerslikeangels, or if you want to follow Explore More as well, it's actually EXPL_MORE. And Explore More shares pictures of the community that's building around this mantra. And on Strangers Like Angels, it's just additional pictures that aren't in their book. But definitely invite you guys to come check it out.
Yeah, they're good pictures. I mean, the ones in the book are outstanding. Who's the photographer?
Well, I think we both would take photos. We have one camera, and we just took the photos as the opportunity came.
For the photo geeks, what kind of camera?
It was one of the original point-and-shoot an Olympus Trip 35.
Nice.
Which I'd used in the Antarctic, and we took it along on a trip also. And
that's some street cred for that camera.
If Olympus is listening, then definitely reach out for any sponsorship.
You still have it? You still have that camera?
It's somewhere in possessions.
Nice. Nice.
Alec doesn't throw anything away, so I'm sure we've got it somewhere.
This is great. This is fantastic.
I'm assuming we're talking 35 millimeter?
Yeah, 35 millimeter using Kodachrome 2 slide film.
Excellent.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So you're in Afghanistan, and you went through Iran. Any interesting stories out of Iran? Because at the time, that was a little more Western leading.
Well, it was still under the Shah at that time.
Actually, 79 was also when the Shah was dethroned.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't have so many adventures in Iran. It was very, you could tell there was money there.
Very cheap gas. Gas was 10 cents a gallon.
Yeah, so you didn't worry about your consumption.
No.
No.
So the book is Strangers Like Angels. Yeah, I had to look at my notes. It's Strangers Like Angels, and that's because of all the people that you encountered along the way, and you've told us a couple stories. Is there any others that pop up to mind of the strangers that helped you out along the way?
There was one particular early story in Algeria when we were still before we got to the Sahara Desert, and we parked the vehicle in the evening on the side of a road in the mountains, and it was on there was a triangular bit of grass on the side of the road, and I was busy cooking the meal, and I always would cook the meal inside the vehicle, and a knock at the door, and there was a young lad who came there, and he was greeting us, and we didn't speak French, but anyway, we were polite and greeted him back, and off he went. And as I finished preparing the meal, which we had fish and bread, and there was a knock at the door, and this lad was there with his older brother, and they came with a basket of bread and a platter with cooked fish on, and they handed us this meal. And at that time, it seemed we could, what could we do? We already had our food, and here we had more food. So eventually we had to show them our dinner was ready, and then they left. And then we didn't enjoy the meal at all because we felt we hadn't responded maybe in the way that was appropriate. But anyway, we continued on, and eventually it was time to make coffee. And lo and behold, there was another knock at the door, and we opened it, and there was the two lads again with a tray with a flask which had coffee in and little cups, and they had brought us coffee to drink. So this time we weren't going to make a mistake again, so we invited them in the back of the Land Rover. They drank our coffee and we drank theirs, and we spent an hour together trying to communicate with pen and paper, and we discovered a lot of things about them and their family. And the next day we had arranged to meet with them and got to visit their farm and ended up at their home to have lunch with them before we set off again on our journey.
A Land Rover mechanical story would be one in India. At the time we were traveling with our Swiss friends, Jean-Luc, the guy was a school teacher, no doubt a very good school teacher, but the extent of his mechanical knowledge extended to where the gas went in. And at a time when in India, he started having trouble with his brakes, and it was at a time when they used to have red brake fluid and white brake fluid, and you shouldn't mix the two. Well, his local friendly garage put the wrong fluid in, and these brakes seals were all gone soft. So we took off all the seals, went into the motor section of the market in Delhi, and finished up in a shop run by Sikhs, the turbaned Indian men. And they didn't import that particular Land Rover into India, so he couldn't say, well, I want a set of front and back axle seals for whatever it was. We had to match each individual seal. Well, these guys went through all their boxes and eventually finished up with a pile of suitable seals on the counter. And we said, what do we owe you for these? And their reply stunned us. They said, oh, no charge, you're guests in our country. We won't accept any payment for them. So, wow. Again, another example of angels we met along the way.
Mechanical angels.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that brings to mind a question that I had. As a someone who honed his Land Rover experience in the Army fixing machines, did you find yourself tempted to bring way too many tools on this trip or not enough?
I think just about sufficient. We went to a company in London, Brown Church Components, from whom we bought our roof rack, and they put together a spares package for our trip, which was pretty adequate. A few things that we found were missing, and we had to be ingenious on thinking of a solution to fix the machine. But all these stories are in the book. So.
Oh, yeah, don't give away free content. No, you want to make it by the book.
Buy the book.
Absolutely, buy the book, exactly.
And the book is available on the Explore More website?
Yep, that goes directly to there, and you'll find the book and additional other products, including beautiful prints of their photos and note cards that you can send to your friends to inspire other people to go and do as a trip as they did. So.
I want the lapel pin. I'm going to be ordering the lapel pin.
Brilliant.
Yeah, it's their Silhouette truck.
And how much is the book?
$20.
Okay, very good. Yeah, for the quality of the book that I'm seeing here, that's a really good buy.
That's a good deal. And it's also excellent for any as a holiday Christmas gift for any of your friends who want to know more about overlanding and travel and cultural cross-cultural exchange of information.
And as a special gift to the listeners, we are doing a promo code for you guys for it's just we've Center
never,
Sphere.
Wait, we've never had a promo code before. This is new. Hold on.
We need a sound effect right now.
Hold a drop in sound effect. Okay, I don't know what I'll pick. We'll do something. Anyway, so what's the promo code?
Yeah, you can get a 10% off, and if you use Center Steer, so just as you write it, C E N T R E S T E R,
as Her Majesty intended.
Mm-hmm.
We're still an independent country, though. You know, around here we still spell it in the American way.
Well, some do. We don't.
Yeah, you know, I used to work with a guy who actually was an American, but he liked Britain so much he actually spelled things in British English, and annoyed everybody.
Oh, I'm sure
it was. It was. So, how many other overlanders did you encounter throughout your trip? I mean, you talked about the folks from Switzerland, but at that time, were there a lot of was that a lot happening? Seems like there's a big increase lately in folks overlanding, but how was it back in back in the 70s?
Well, there was quite a community on the road of various European countries, Australians, New Zealanders.
Mixture of vehicles. You'd see the good old Volkswagen camper bus. Even one couple we met with a Citroen 2CB.
Nice.
That's special.
In the Sahara.
They're even more special than Land Rover people.
Well, the good thing about the Citroen 2CB, you can just pick it up. If it gets stuck, you just pick it up and put it back on the road again.
You don't have to worry about boiling over the radiator either.
All right. Tell me more about Bulgaria. And I also noticed on the way back you went through Skopje, which is Macedonia. And since that's land of my forefathers and foremothers, any little interesting stories, anything you remember? If you don't, that's fine too.
Yeah, I don't particularly remember stories from there. No.
That's fine.
Not I would come up with immediately.
Yeah, I had to ask because, I did get to visit both countries back in 2005, and Macedonia reminds me of Pennsylvania, which is interesting. And Pennsylvania reminds me of Wales, too, just as a little interesting tidbit of geographic information.
Okay.
Yeah. So you drove back, you got all the way to Kathmandu. And then you turned around and came right back.
That's right. And then we kept more southerly because it was winter time. We were December 1977, at Christmas, we were in Nepal, in Kathmandu. And then as we were heading west, obviously it was winter conditions, so we would keep as south as we could. But when we got into Turkey, we were so far south that we really got into a very snow-covered landscape, didn't we, and roads. And there's an exciting story in the book that tells of how we met, as the book is called Strangers Like Angels with the Devil of Chutubu. This is when we met someone who was behaving more like a devil than an angel. And so that was a little bit of a freaky time that we had an adventure there.
So we call that a close call? Would that be a...
Oh, we've very tense.
It's a very surprising ending, a very good ending. It could potentially have been a whole lot different. But,
Well, obviously it was positive because you're still with us now. So that's...
Exactly.
Buy the book.
Exactly. Buy the book if you want to know what happens. Well, we know you're still with us, so that's obviously that's a good thing.
Yeah, we really that one's kind of a spoiler that's inherent.
Tell us more about the Land Rover, since this is the world's only Land Rover podcast, and that's what we focus on. It was brand new to you. Do you still have it? Is it in need of a restoration? Where is it?
Well, you're asking all the right questions there. The Land Rover originated with my uncle. As I say, he was a big farmer. He bought it brand new. I think he was about 2 years old when we took it on. Blue and white, hard top, had the 2.6-litre gasoline engine, straight six. And I spent time on it, put an elevating roof, sleeping accommodation, cupboards, toilet facilities.
Extra fuel tank.
And
capstone winch on the front we had.
Yeah, which again, a few stories when we told about the use of the winch. We didn't actually use it to rescue ourselves, but it was jolly useful, saving us time helping other people. We got several incidents where we were able to use the winch to rescue other people.
Yeah, capstan winch is more useful for winching other things than and not so much for rescuing your own truck, just by virtue of its design.
Yeah, it was the, I guess when I bought it, it was at the time the more economy
choice.
But it served us well.
They're now a collectible piece of kit.
We should have kept it. Sold it when we got back, didn't we?
Yeah, that's right.
Because we used the vehicle when we got back, as our day-by-day vehicle. And then when we started having children, we did some traveling with them in the Land Rover into Europe. And, in fact, there was a period of 3 months when we lived outside of Paris in a trailer park. And we had a very small caravan, trailer, just a very small one, not much bigger than the Land Rover. Mm-hmm. And we had our two daughters, Esther and Heidi, and then Charles, he was just 6 weeks old. He was with us too, and we all lived in this little tiny caravan. We were there for 3 months for learning French, and we had a homeschool teacher, and she lived in the Land Rover.
It's not often you get to hear Paris and trailer park in the same sentence. That's nice.
That's wonderful. That's good. See, you learned French in France, and you lived in basically the size of two Land Rovers.
Exactly.
Yeah, there we go.
Tiny house living.
So where's the truck now? Is it in Germany?
Yeah, it's in Germany, parked in the corner of our garden. Makes a good platform for putting geraniums and potted plants on, but a very sad sight. But she is ready for restoration, and this is one of our dreams to get her back on the road again, sort the engine out, maybe even put a more modern, up-to-date engine in. As you know, Land Rovers, anything's possible when it comes to mechanical modifications.
Indeed. Really?
Indeed. So is the book part of the journey to restore the Landy?
Well, it could be that
I'm trying to sell more books. I figure that'll, you know, maybe folks will, if they, you know, that might help to
exactly
supply the funds. It doesn't have to be. I'm just really curious. Helped.
Sorry, I missed that.
I was just curious if the book would help to fund restoration efforts, and if it doesn't, that's okay too.
Well, we would like to sell more books so that we can have more funds and the possibility of renovating the Land Rover.
That'd be excellent. That'd be a good deal. We definitely support the keeping Land Rovers on the road.
How is the German government as far as regulations on something that old?
Well, we've done some inquiries with the local TÜV office, which is the German annual or biannual inspection. And, yeah, it's possible there are certain criteria we've got to meet, but it should be possible to get it through the required tests.
Excellent.
Very nice.
How long did you use it after the journey? Did you park it when you were done, or did it see some more time? It sounds like you did take it on some more camping trips, though.
Yeah, we used it for 7 years after the trip, and then we went back to live in Mali, West Africa, for 14 years. And every 2 years when we came back home, we would take the Land Rover out from a barn where it was being stored and take it on the road again to use for the 3 months we were home. So we did that for another maybe two or three times, and another six years. So probably that was 13 years after the trip we carried on using it.
Excellent. Excellent. That's good. So I have the ultimate question. Would you do this all over again?
Well,
answer as you like.
When we went and lived in Mali in West Africa, we spent 14 years driving overland because that was the nature of the work that we had there. We were bush driving all the time and up in the desert and driving up to Timbuktu and so on.
What were you driving?
Well, I've got to admit here, there's a few Land Rovers figure on the on the fleet, but there's a few Land Cruisers and other unmentionable Japanese vehicles we got to use also.
But we had a great discovery, didn't we?
Oh, yeah, we did have. We had a discovery. We were involved for some time on a water well digging program, and the discovery was the vehicle choice to support that program.
I take it the vehicle choice was not yours.
Well, no, it was no. That was a company vehicle. So, yeah.
Nice.
So clearly, the answer is yes. You just continued living that lifestyle.
Exactly. Exactly.
You never really stopped, actually.
Yeah. Well, and you know, the adventure now is to share the story and to inspire the next generation to do the next thing. And so, you know, if we do sell enough books and any future projects that we work on, we do hope to push that into revamping the Land Rover and possibly taking it to places it hasn't been before. You know, I'm competing with the three other sisters that I have, who will be the next one to take it to somewhere it hasn't been. So we do intend on keeping the legacy going forward.
I vote for Antarctica.
Well, it hasn't been to North America yet either.
Oh yes. It hasn't been to the Americas at all. No Americas.
That would be fun, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Would it be allowed to bring it over like as us visitors?
Yes.
You know?
Actually, yes. It's much easier for you as I'm going to use the expression foreign nationals, no offense, but as non-citizens, you can bring in pretty much anything you want, but for a limited period of time. You can't sell it and you can't keep it here indefinitely, but it's much tougher for us as citizens to import something than it is for non-citizens.
Right. In fact, the very first Discovery 3 I ever saw was right-hand drive that was brought in to the country for, I think, 6 months.
Well, and just a few days ago, we witnessed a South African 130 that rolled through here.
And that's correct. And
with South African plates on it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So, yeah, that's easy to do, actually. That's much, much more easy to bring a non-American vehicle into the country without meeting the regulations that we have.
Though importing a 70s series Land Rover is not too difficult.
No, that's true. You could import and title it here if you wanted. Yeah, that's easy too at this point.
Like, for instance, if Charles was going to take over ownership or something like that, it could easily be done.
That's right.
Although it had a petrol engine originally, but then you switched it out for diesel.
That gets a little trickier.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think on a Series 3 they probably wouldn't care as much.
Yeah, I think on something that's 40 years old, they're not going to look as carefully as if it was a Defender.
If it was a Defender, then
that's a hot button for the government right now.
Yeah, but a Series 3, I mean, my Series 3 was, 30 years old when I brought it in?
That was before the crackdown, mind you.
True, but yeah. So Explore More is, Charles, you started that around the book to encourage people to do what your parents did. And can you tell us more about Explore More? And first of all, how do you spell it?
So Explore More is spelled E-X-P-L-M-O-R-E. I'm being very creative. I'm a graphic designer as a day job. I work at an ad agency, so I dream in branding and various ventures that I've tried to do. Explore More started out of the fact that I was inspired by my parents writing this book. And as we saw, you know, the interest in it, and my sisters and I heard about this story endless times throughout the time we were growing up. And, you know, it was only sort of recently how impactful the story can be to sort of inspire myself and other, you know, fellow overlanders with this industry that seems to be exploding, especially here in the U.S., so I just thought it would be a great opportunity to create a lifestyle brand that sort of created a community of adventurers who might take inspiration from this story back in 1977. And, you know, I think it's also important that people not only explore more, but, you know, engage more with others and embrace other cultures, because, you know, by overlanding, we're essentially visiting other cultures and food and just beautiful places all around the world that, you know, oftentimes the media portrays it as such dangerous and scary places to go, which obviously you have to be careful. But I think the importance of continuing to explore more really, you know, drives that need for conversation between countries. You know, we can't be
absolutely
putting up gates and things like that. So,
and are you planning your own trip yet?
Well, my wife and I are expecting a baby in April, so that'll be the next trip for me.
Well, you were in a caravan after 6 weeks? Come on.
Yeah, really. You were living in a trailer park in Paris.
Outside of Paris.
I personally took ownership of a 97 D1, so I'm enjoying sort of...
Good place,
you know,
to start.
Again, yeah. I did some good research on it, but, you know, my dad's a mechanic, and as computers were becoming more and more technologically advanced, I took interest in graphic design. So I'm sort of circling back now and tinkering with my own Land Rover, taking on trips and, you know, enjoying the countryside here in Virginia. But, yeah, you know, with the efforts of selling the book and hopefully revamping their Land Rover, I'd love to go on a great trip with the same vehicle. So that's the ultimate goal.
Good, good. So what other projects are planned? I know you're, I guess, talking about a photo coffee book and in addition to the rehab project. And I know you have a website. So what else is happening around Explore More?
So, yeah. Well, next year is 2017, and that's the 40th anniversary since my parents went on their trip. So it with the interest in the book and the story, it seemed fitting that we would expand on that. And for those who, you know, not necessarily readers, we were thinking possibly about expanding the story into a photo coffee table book. And, you know, with today's crowdfunding platforms, we're hoping that we might be able to do a Kickstarter at some point and
I'll be your first supporter.
Really? Yeah, so I'm using that platform to sort of raise the funds in order to revamp the Land Rover is the goal, and out of that we'll hopefully be able to create a photo book too that you know, shows all of their amazing photography and possibly some added, you know, facts and interesting tips for those who are going out on a trip, because, you know, again, they did it very simply, and I think that that's also an important thing to remember for myself too, is remembering the basics. I drive around all the time on my phone and rely on it too much that, you know, I find sometimes when I run out of battery, I need to remember the basics, make sure I get home on time. So, So yeah, that's one of the projects. And then, you know, of course, we're continually adding products to our website, and we're hopefully going to be building out a podcast as well in the new year.
Hold on. Don't be competing. No, I support your efforts.
Some people enjoy listening to the story as they drive along in their cars off to their job. So we're thinking it might be a great opportunity to develop a podcast around the story and sort of release excerpts of the book over time so that people can enjoy it.
It's a great idea.
Yeah. I hear this podcast thing is catching on.
Indeed it is. That's great. I support that. And we talked about it at the Overland Expo, and even possibly doing your own audio version, I think wouldn't be a bad idea. So is there another book in off, Jan and Alec? Or are you thinking of something else? Maybe like Antarctica? I find Antarctica fascinating.
When Alec was in the Antarctic, our only communication was by letters. And so we have a huge box full of hundreds of letters which tell all the fascinating facts and so on of his time down there. And
that sounds like a great book, just putting the letters up.
So that's a possibility. We also have our adventures in Mali. When we were there, we would write a newsletter every 2 weeks. So we also have files, binders of these letters that also could be drawn on for lots of stories.
Wow.
Excellent.
Okay, once again, you two are badass. And that's a good thing, by the way. Yeah, you know that.
Speaking of badass, you got to look at the picture in the overleaf of the book, because there's a picture of Jan and Alec from 1972. And Alec is sporting a serious Steve McQueen here there, who is a badass of badasses.
Indeed, a nice turtleneck. We like that. That looks really good.
Yeah, my sisters and I like to joke that that's when they were movie stars.
I was thinking. I was going to say, this looks like this is a movie star, you know, it was an action photo here. This looks like you guys are you're getting ready for a James Bond film or something.
Maybe. And I'd like to say that we had great help from children to develop the book. Our eldest daughter, she did all the cover and the illustrations inside, and the photos, we had over 1,300 slides, which our youngest daughter did all the scanning of those and producing the different photograph pages. And our third daughter, she was the quality controller. And she wouldn't let anything pass by unless it was done to a professional standard. And, of course, Charles has been a social media expert. So we've been very blessed to have such a family project with this book.
Outstanding. And everything they've said is true. The book, the writing, the photos, the quality is up there. You really could have charged more than $20, I think. It says £12.99 on the back, but you're charging 20 American. You're probably going to get away with a little more.
Well, there's plenty of other cool products to check out. We've got great T-shirts and hats and note cards and things. So,
and a lapel pin. I'm getting a lapel pin.
Lapel pins, yeah.
As soon as we're done tonight, I'm going to order a lapel pin. Well, thank you very much for coming on the show and talking about the book and talking about your adventures. It's absolutely amazing. The fact that you Alec, you went to Antarctica just is that's killer.
You're not going to get past that, are you?
No, I think it's so cool. How many people have gotten to say they got to Antarctica let alone three times?
So, John, I think you're going to have to add Antarctica to your destination for your trip.
No, that's not going to happen. I don't mind the cold, but that's a little too much for me. You know, they now make you take if you're going to Antarctica, you have not had your appendix out, they will take it out before you go, just in case it doesn't you don't have a problem when you get there.
Remove it at the gate as you're boarding the airplane?
That's exactly correct. They do some pre-medical pre-medical
surgery. Have your boarding pass and your appendix,
please. Yes. Thanks again, Alec and Jan. I really appreciate it. This is really cool.
You're very welcome.
Very inspiring story. It's great to see that you're, you know, expanding it out to everybody.
That's what the podcast is all about, sharing information and talking about stuff that we enjoy and like and have a passion for. And clearly you guys have a passion for traveling and getting to meet other people and your Land Rover. So that's it is very inspiring. That's a good word, inspiring.
Yep.
Thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to share our story.
So, yeah, thank you again for having us on here. Just a couple other reminders. We're doing, you know, for the great listeners of this podcast, if you use CenterSteer on exploremore.com, you can get 10% off the book and other cool merchandise. And again, Explore More is spelled E-X-P-L-M-O-R-E. And then definitely come over to Instagram and Facebook and find us on there as well. We're sort of building a great community across the world of just people going out and exploring more. And you know, that's what it's all about. So if you come to Explore More, you can join the community and you can sign up there. And I'll send you a free decal that you can put on your various overland rigs. And then just use hashtag Explore More and share it all to the rest of the world.
And I will have links in the show notes to all the information he talked about. The promo code will not be advertised. You have to listen to the show. I have to do this one final time. Alec, I'm going to give Alec and Jan the final thank you, and then I'll let you guys close out the segment. So thanks again, Jan and Alec.
Thank you, too.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, guys, for giving us the opportunity to share our story.
This week I received my Rovers magazine from Rovers North, and one of our listeners has an article in here, Sam Watson, who is a Yorkshire native, and he travels to Egypt quite often and listens to the show, so shout out to Sam for listening, and I think he's one of our Patreon listeners too. I think he got the very first sticker when those came out. He was our first Patreon supporter. So there's an article in there that he wrote this is the holiday 2016 edition of the Rovers magazine. Check that out.
He listens to our show whilst in Egypt?
Indeed.
So would he count as an Egyptian listener or a UK listener?
I believe he is a Briton who travels to Egypt. So he,
okay.
Yes.
I just wonder how does that count in our... Well, there we go. Get double credit. We'll give him dual citizenship.
There we go.
Exactly.
And also, last month, we talked to Brian of Alloy and Grit magazine, and since then, the magazine came out. This is the North American Independent Land Rover magazine, and it is as nice as he talked about. And so if you have not already, or if you thought about it, I do encourage you to go out and check out the magazine. It's very nicely done, nice articles. It is as good as they say it is.
It is, and I haven't gotten time to fully peruse it, my copy, yet, but it's awesome.
Hey, I have a lot of reading to do. I'm way behind, so I understand completely. Many of the things we've talked about in the last couple months are actually included in the magazine. Terry Wakeman and Graham Bell both have a little mentions in here about their books. I believe Ryan's off-road trail guide, I saw a mention in here about that also. And of course, we were able to get an ad in the magazine too, so that's pretty cool. I appreciate us having that opportunity. And so, yeah, check it out. It's as good as it, again, as good as they claim it to be. So this will be a nice one to leave on your coffee table in the during the holiday season when friends and family come to visit. And
since recording this episode of the podcast, our friend and frequent contributor Dave was readmitted to the hospital. Our thoughts go out to him and his family for a speedy recovery. And a thank you to Mike Woodier for the kind note about the podcast. A sticker is on its way. And also a shout out to The One True Pax for his production support.
So that's the podcast for this month. I hope you enjoyed the show, and thank you for listening. I want to remind you to visit our website to be able to listen to all our past shows and check out the show notes, which have links to the stories we talked about. You can connect with us on Facebook and Twitter especially. We're always interested in your feedback on the things we discussed or new ideas, or if you have an idea for a guest, always open to those. You can also directly support the show through our Patreon account. That's Patreon, patreon.com/CenterSteer. Center, of course, spelled in the British way. If you'd like to be a sponsor of the podcast, hey, send me an email. I'm looking at you, Kelly Kettle. They just started following me following the show on Twitter, and I'd like a Kelly kettle, so maybe we can work something out. is that a shameless plug? We'd also like to hear from our listeners, even if it's just a picture of a Land Rover that you own or one that you lust over. Go ahead and send those over. Until next time, I ask you to share the show with another Land Rover fan. Thank you for listening. Wave as we pass by. Say anything more because you didn't get a chance to speak too much. You all right?
No, I'm good.
You all right, brother? All right, good.